right. Today, I'm joined by casting director Debbie Manwiller, who's a two-time Emmy Award winner for her work on the shows 24 and Chicago Hope. And some of her more recent work includes the likes of The Blacklist. Debbie, how are you doing? And thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Great. It's I know we were talking just before we hit record here. It's, I hate to tell you, it's a gorgeous 68 degrees Southern California day today here. It's always good. Always good.
And my go-to with everybody at the moment is, like, obviously tough year. How has it been for you personally, professionally, over the last eight or so months?
Yeah, I mean, it's a year like none other. It's impacted us all, you know, the world over in ways both large and small. And there will be dogs barking. I just want to warn you, I have three. So that's why my headset, but we'll see what happens. Yeah, from, you know, family and illness and you know, just loss of our regular routines, and our work world is upended. And yeah, I mean, I have, you know, if you want to get into in detail, we were working on something before the pandemic, like just, you know, at the end of February, and got in the most of the LA casting just before then. But then, you know, it was supposed to start filming in June in Atlanta. Mm. And that was delayed a couple of times, and actually did wrap just a couple of weeks ago outside of Atlanta with no incidents of COVID, which is amazing. And, you know, I think things are, I don't know, you'd have to tell me how different they are in terms of what's picked back up in the UK versus what's picked back up here. It's much slower.
It's much slow. Slower. It seems slow. It seems like it's the very big networks and studio projects, but also the stuff that was already happening before lockdown, either that they had prepped, to your point with your project, or they'd done one or two seasons before and they had insurance was in place, or, you know, that was all there. And indie film seems like it might be a bit of a harder thing to pull off
now. It seems like there has to have been some infrastructure, like series, let's say, that, you know, had been going for a while. They don't have to reinvent the wheel. They have their same crew. They have a level of trust amongst one another. They don't have to go and build new sets and scout new locations. It's already happening. And then big budget things like, you know, Jurassic, which had been shooting in the UK, and, you know, they have boatloads of money, so they can rent an entire universe and make it, you know, safe in that way. Indies, you know, in some ways, you know, there's less, you know, rules governing what's happening there. So people are getting out to shoot. You know, SAG has, you know, approved a number of independents as well. And I know commercials seem to be the first thing that came back, but that's, you know, skeleton crews, and it's a much easier, you know, get to have happen. But
I mean, they were doing them on Zoom for some of them. I have a friend who did one.
Yeah.
He's New York based. He just did it in Zoom. Which I suppose is great initially, just to get us back into their groove. But I think long-term sustainability is not with Zoom for performance in terms of the actual end product.
It's difficult.
What about in terms of actually auditions and stuff? Have you got back into that groove, and has it been Zoom-based, or you're not quite there?
Everything is Zoom-based. Like I said, we had the thing that we were doing was largely cast. Sure. So the things that we were kind of finishing up were offers and going back to people who had already been seen, or they did self-tapes. And, you know, now things are just happening on Zoom. There's no in-person auditions happening that I know of, and they shouldn't. And, you know, it's kind of, for better or for worse, it's an extension of what was happening before. This was not, you know, it's just more extreme, and it's on everything now. But, you know, there were virtual auditions happening already. Producers were tired of coming into the room, or you couldn't always get them into the room already. So, you know, there's definitely, I hope not all of that sticks. I have big opinions about, you know, what I feel about, you know, self-tapes and about having to, you know, put actors in that place. It's hard for actors to get their barometer.
Well, that's the thing. It's that we've got nothing to run with, because we don't really have any adjustments, especially with the self-tape, because you kind of just put it out into the ether and hope for the best.
You know, because it is that way. I mean, we've been having this conversation for several years now, as it sort of, like, you know, it became the edict from the studios and the networks and our clients, the people that we work for, that everything has to go on tape, regardless of whether we plan on sending it to them or not. They want to see what we're doing. They want to have the option to look at it. And for us too, I mean, you know, it's not all bad. I have a huge library of auditions and things, and I can, you know, sometimes when we're in the thick of it, I'm like, oh my God, you remember the guy who auditioned for that pilot? And oh, we have his audition on tape, and you know, we can show it. And I don't know that we're always supposed to do that, but it's, you know, we have a library, you know, in that way too, that can be helpful. But you know, so the progression of having things, you know, happen more and more on tape, where, you know, producers wanted to be in the room less and less. And that's not that all producers, nobody wants to have contact with actors. It's really a time management sort of thing. And it's like, oh, casting is a huge time suck in terms of, more in terms of television and pilot. I mean, that's, I would say that certainly the last half of my career, I've been working more in television than in film. But, you know, it mirrors that in film as well. And to have people have the, you know, after 3 hours of a location scout and the comments and casting for 2 hours, you know, it's hard to keep people's attention. I mean, it just is. And so the freedom that came with everything going on tape and having these sites like Casted and Breakdown Services and, you know, the to be able to do casting anywhere, anytime, and then bring your producers in kind of for the end of it. You know, I saw that the changes were happening where all of a sudden you weren't having as many people in the room, which is good to some extent. There's, you know, less opinions flying around in that space. But, you know, what happens then is that if we're begging to get people to come into the room and to make time for it, we have to prioritize how many roles we can see, what roles we need to see. And, you know, it ends up being, you know, in television, you know, the series regular roles, certainly a pilot as a whole is a different thing. But larger roles, and then the co-stars and day roles and the smaller roles have largely been relegated to, you know, we put them on tape and then we show them to the producers and have a cyberspace session. Sure. And, you know, we've learned how to navigate those waters so that the things that are harder, you know, we need that immediate feedback too, because if I set up 2 days worth of sessions and see all these roles and we're off track or they change their mind, and you know, then there's a delayed response to, you know, how quickly we can respond to that too. But, you know, back to the barometer, you know, it's really, you know, I think it's hard, especially for actors that are just starting out, to, you have to be able to get that energy, that vibe in the room. And that's how you develop that, is by being in the room with somebody, having that immediate feedback. No, do it again. Oh, wait, way too hot. No, try this. And we do get to do some of that. And, you know, but we learn playing the game of telephone tag with agents and managers and the actors themselves saying, you know, I want you to do one like this. And then, you know, take a pause here.
But it's not quite the same. It's that same thing of like when you get a text message from somebody, you lose all of the emotional context. Exactly. So, you know, I could have my agent tell me that they want you to do it again. And these are like a bunch of notes, but it feels a lot more impersonal than in the room. Yeah. Getting the note, and then you can read the vibe and go, oh, well, I'm not going to take that personally. Not that we should ever, but you know what we're like. We're sensitive. We do.
It's true. But it's a lot harder in a vacuum, right? And it's hard, you know, just like the text example is the perfect analogy, because, you know, what I might type might sound curt, or it might sound, you know, it might just not, I can do this with you and I can say, you know, that thing that you just did, I want that moment. But then, you know, take a pause here, take this in a different direction. And those are the kinds of things, that immediacy, that I fear losing it. But I think, you know, I've been doing it for a minute. And so I've been doing it since before we put anybody on tape, and now this revolution where, you know, it's just all changed and it's all online. And the, I like seeing actors in the room. That's my favorite part of the job, is to do the auditions. The rest of it.
I'm shocked about that. That's like the only reason the majority of casting people are really into it is because they either were a performer, or they just love that creative aspect. And it makes total sense. I mean, the admin side.
Yeah, I was for a minute. But the part of it, you know, that's the fun part of the job. That's the most creative part of the job, is to be able, you know, we write those lists and we think about, you know, who could bring it to life. And then someone comes in and brings something to us that we hadn't thought of and surprises us. That's like, that's what we live for. And there is there are urban myths cautionary tales that I hear flying around about other casting directors, not necessarily all, you know, younger and coming up, that are putting more and more of their pre-reads on tape and sort of using that and not really bringing actors into the room. This is before COVID. And sort of using that and saying, you know, I'm just going to have my session and have everybody, you know, put themselves on tape, and then I'll call through it. I'll go through everything.
Do you think that that's sort of an evolutionary thing generationally in terms of just the role of technology in our society? This is kind of a bit more macro than just our industry, but.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I do, because it seems like a normal thing to do. And why wouldn't that be good? But I think it's lazy casting. Like, right. I do. I mean, I will say that to anybody who's, you know, that's listening. I think that's lazy casting because, I mean, not that I have asked people to self-tape, and we will do that for a really small role and something that I feel like I might not need to give direction on, right? Or I'll say, give me one that's got a little, you know, a little humor to it. Give me something else. I will always communicate with the agent. You know, if it's me, I take your order, sir. I probably don't need that person to come into the room and spend an hour in traffic and parking, all those things. So it's really not out of me not wanting to sit in the room and see people, but to say, you know, you don't really need my help. You know, you don't really need me to help guide you. You know, our role is to try to, you know, get the piece cast, but to try to help the actor get the role. And so this, you know, this shift of some people kind of just doing it all and not having people come into the room because it's easier or it just seems normal. I really, really am against it. I don't think it helps. I don't think it's good for the casting process. I don't think it's good for the casting director. Mm. You know, people who are just starting out, and we have a barometer too of what it feels like to see someone in the room and putting things on tape and being able to see them both live and then seeing what it lives like when it's here. There are times when my opinion changes. I'll go, oh my God, that was great. You know, in the room, it's like, you know, because you're caught up in that part of it. And then somebody that you sort of didn't spark to and didn't really see it. And then the roles might reverse as I'm watching. I'm like, oh, you know, that, you know, there were these great things that they were doing just in the subtlety of the performance, or in this other person, it seems like it's pushing now. It just doesn't seem right. But you know, the camera doesn't lie, and it picks up things and it picks up the truth of what somebody is doing.
And I guess there's that argument of, because it's come up a few times when I've been talking to people about, well, ultimately when we're doing stuff on screen, it's about how you can emote and actually make someone feel something through the medium of this screen that we're working with. So Zoom and self-tapes is kind of the perfect conduit for that. But I guess the flip side, now having listened to what you just said, is also that before we even get to that stage, we have to work on set in real life with people. And you are effectively the sort of de facto first port of call for how a director is going to work with the actor when you're auditioning them. And I guess you need to see if we can take notes in the flesh.
Well, the thing about self-tapes and the thing about booking somebody off of a self-tape, if I don't know their work, I don't know the agent, I've kind of done it cold. And, you know, we do that a lot, especially for smaller roles. You know, I want to give people that, you know, need the work and want the work a chance to come up and get the SAG card or, you know, build the resume. And when somebody sends me a self-tape, I don't know if that's the 20th take or the first take, you know? And I've been burned by that before and, you know, have learned that I cannot necessarily trust it. And again, I like actors. I want to see the work. It's, you know, it's not us versus them, but I have to be aware that somebody might've been in the room and, you know, maybe they went to a coach and spent, you know, 3 days on the scene, or they, you know, for better or for worse, the performance can have been altered. They might have had a lot of distractions at home, and, like, you know, who knows, their kid is like banging on the door, and, you know, whatever the things are, both for, you know, to enhance or to take away from the performance. So that part of it, I have to keep that in mind. And that's why, you know, coming into the room or having a callback, and like you said, taking the direction. I mean, that's, you know, that's what it is.
That's the
job.
I want to see
if somebody can, you know, be facile with the material and to be able to, you know, take it in a completely different direction.
And so when you say you've been burnt and you don't have to pull on that thread if it's something you can't, but are you talking about it from the perspective of the performance and not knowing if they can take those notes? Or do you mean more that you can't gauge them just
in terms of personality? I hired somebody that I shouldn't have, because you know, it was small and it was good. And we didn't think that much about it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, we have to be vigilant and take the time and not get lazy in casting. And I suppose we got a little lazy and or complacent. And, you know, my job, a lot of it is about it's quality control and I'm an editor. And so when I'm bringing those choices to the producer, director, studio, whatever, that's my taste. That's my aesthetic. That's my reputation on the line. And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, I believe in these choices.
Sure.
What do you think? And then we have, working with people who are great and creative, then you have a dialogue. No, I didn't see this. Why not? Tell me what it was that, you know, that you were missing. Not necessarily advocating for the person one way or another, but just to dig in and drill down a little deeper about what, you know, what you want, what you think is going to bring, you know, bring this alive. And then, you know, our wheels start turning and we start thinking about, you know, the actor that we saw in the play or the person that we saw two pilots ago and all those things. So when I say I've been burned, it was like, you know, it was my own fault, right?
Sure.
You know, the actor just couldn't replicate what they did on the tape.
Yeah, now I think that was my thing. I wasn't sure if it was burnt from the sense of their personality, because you can't gauge that on the tape, and they were just they were an asshole on set, which is also another way of your reputation getting burnt. I found it really fascinating that you mentioned how you're like an editor, because that's the first time someone said it so implicitly, but it makes complete sense to me just processing it. So in terms of your process, are you always sort of, when you're bringing in the actor, cutting in your head what the scene and that part of the show would look like with them in that role? Or is that a bit too?
Not that far down the pike. I mean, when I say editor, I'm really talking about, you know, I could cast projects 100 times over with the amount of great actors that there are that could do the role. So part of it is, you know, the choices that we make and who we're going to bring in. And whether it's from a list or whether it's from pitches from the agents or whether it's from, you know, things we've already seen and done and pulling those people together, I am, I'm culling down, I'm sorting through, I'm editing the choices, editing in the best sense of the word, not sure. Like, you know, to, you know, prevent somebody from getting something or leaving on the cutting room floor, but to say, you know, I'm making very specific choices about the people that I want to bring in. And, you know, we start, you know, what we start out with at the beginning of a project and a role may not be what we end up with. And it might be because an actor turns some, you know, like some spark into the writer going, oh my God, I never thought about the role that way. Let's run with that kind of direction a little bit. And maybe that person gets the role. So the editing is really about, you know, it's about quality control and about saying, this is what I think. Am I right? What do you, you know, and then the collaboration starts. I mean, you know, we're not always right, you know, but that's the creative part of it. But what I better be right about is that everybody that walks through the door is that they're good.
Sure.
You know, that they deserve the seat in the room because, you know, they've been working on their craft and they're going to do their deal in the room, you know?
And so for people that you know, or you've had them come in before, you've, you know, booked before, you can kind of gauge that. But for you, when you don't know people, and you mentioned how you do want to bring in new talent because that's part of the job too, how do you go about gauging that, especially given now the context of not maybe being in the room for a while?
Right. I mean, you know, that's part of why I always like to, you know, just have a little bit of interaction, you know, with the person. And, you know, we run a pretty happy room, you know, my partner and I, and, you know, I like to just, it's like the part that you can't bottle and that you can't necessarily quantify and write down the rules. It's like, you kind of vibe somebody and it's like, you know, what energy are they giving off and whether that's something that they've calculated and that's the energy of the character, or, you know, does this person seem like an asshole? Does this person seem like somebody that I would want to have on a set for, you know, the 7 years of a series that, you know, they aren't, if they can't take a direction in the room, if they seem resistant, if they seem, you know, there's some kind of God complex going on or whatever that thing is, like, you know, we do vibe on that. And we do, it is part of the calculus of, you know, when we start thinking about who would be right for the role. You know, I don't want to bring somebody in that is, you know, as good as they are, that's going to bring, you know, a world of pain to a particular production. You know, the flip side of that is that I believe that people change, you know, for good and for bad, for better and for worse. You know, somebody that went through, you don't know, somebody goes through a rough patch in their life and those things affect us. I mean, we're all human. And that's a part of it too. It's like, I think that casting is the single most subjective part of the creative process in filmmaking, hands down. Because like my shirt's green, right? It's green. Unless you're colorblind, we're all going to agree that it is some shade of green, right? And a location, there's like certain, there's things that are true and that are, you know, that are factual in terms of other departments. But casting is, you know, beyond, you know, if we're starting at ground zero and the craft is good and somebody, you know, they're good actors. And then, you know, we bring in six really great actors for a role. Then it's about, okay, what best serves the story? What's part of the world that we're trying, you know, what world are we trying to create? Does that person fit in that world? You know, what is my own experience? You know, we're all filtering it through our own lens. It's just human nature. So, you know, we're all going to agree that, you know, a certain person, you know, they feel, somebody might decide, oh, well, that person seems so cold to me. And the other person might think, no, not at all. Because we do have our own, you know, perception about, you know, how we think about people, how we feel about people. Doggy.
They're agreeing. Completely agreeing.
So.
And I think from an actor's side, that's always sort of the frustration, because there's that logical part of our brain that just goes, give me the formula, but there isn't a formula.
No, I wish there was. I would give it to you.
Really? Do you think though, part of the fun, and maybe in a masochistic way, is that there isn't a formula though, because that's the art, like that is the artistry behind what we do. But how, especially for, you know, the newer people starting out, I don't know if there is a nature nurture argument to how you can get to that place of being okay with wanting it, but not needing it. Cause I think you need to want the job, but you know, we can play it too cool for school and do the whole, I don't care if I get it, I get it, which I think is bullshit, but also you don't want to be so like clung into it that you can't authentically then give your take on the story. What's your view on that with everything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's part, you're right, that I think it's bullshit to say it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, it hurts, right? It hurts to like go and put your heart and soul on the line and then to not get something. And, you know, the trick is to be able to come back from that and to, you know, like I know so many actors that have been doing it for a long time that still can't do it. And they're like, oh, it takes them out for days to not be able to get a role. And it is hard because it does feel personal. The rejection does feel personal. How can it not? You know, but to be able to like, okay, this, you know, I say that until you get the job, getting the job is your job. So in terms of sort of learning how to navigate all that and to say, you know, it isn't personal. You know, I needed somebody that didn't look like the lead. I needed somebody who was taller. I needed somebody who was shorter. All these things that you cannot control that are just, you know, the decisions that go into, you know, choosing the person who's going to get it, given the fact that there are, okay, there's six great people here, to be, you know, then start, you know, piece, you know, parsing it out, saying, well, this person brings, you know, a little bit too, I don't know, they don't feel like they would have grown up in like on the South Side, whatever. And the actors act, and I know people can change, and that's what you say, but I could do it. And you probably can't, right? I mean, there's the argument to say that any one of those six people could be it, but then it's about, just drilling down and saying, you know, what is, you know, what makes it most interesting? What makes it the most truthful? And I digressed. Go back to what the question was. There was something more specific, and I'm going offline here.
I went with you on the flow because now I forgot what the question was myself.
Oh, just about the nature versus nurture.
The nature nurture side of how do we get to that point of wanting it but not needing it, and that balance, and there is something we can do.
I mean, I do think it is like every time you get to go in for an audition, whether it's in person, whether it's virtual, it's like you've earned your seat in the room, right? You won the lottery of going in and saying, you know, I'm going to show you my stuff, here I am, because there's thousands of people that were submitted. I mean, I was tell a depressing story about last pilot season. I think 9 series regulars on the project that I was doing. So that's what the breakdown went out for. And I had 18,000 submissions for those roles. 18,000. That's a lot. Now, not all those 18,000 people are right. You know, agents and managers in pilot season, you know, like, not to disparage, but, you know, a lot of them will try the spaghetti approach. Oh, throw it up on the ceiling and see what sticks. And I get it. So half the people, at least half, won't even be right, you know, just given the parameters of the role, age, or, you know, something not right about it. So there's this mentality and this sort of mindset I think you have to get into. It's like, I won. I'm in the room. I may not get the role, but I'm in front of a person who's going to see me, who's going to remember me, who I'm going to do my work for. I'm going to put myself out there, and I'm going to give my version, you know, of this role. This is me. And you know, that's what casting directors do. My job is to remember people that come into the room, you know, that are good, and, you know, write notes, see what happens. I mean, I call it the cross-pollination between projects. We do that all the time. Mm. Anybody who's good at the job, that's what we do. Our job is to remember people. Our job is to, you know, go back and, you know, like I will oftentimes tell an actor, somebody's really good and I can just tell they feel like they hit it. They feel like they were in it and they did great work. But I know for whatever reason that they're not going to get the role because they look too much like the guy we just cast for a different role that nobody knows about, or for whatever reason. And, you know, I'll tell the person, I'll say, you know, I there might be people that would disagree with me, but sometimes I'll say, you know, it's such good work. And if you don't get a callback or if you don't make it, this might be the reason why, but I want you to know so that you can get your barometer, right? And also so that you can carry that piece of confidence with you to go, damn, I thought I was right about that. I thought it was good, because we're on your side. I'm on your team. I want you to come in and make a space where you're going to come in, you're going to do good work, and we are going to have a creative connection while we're there in the room. And I'm going to give you the direction, and hopefully you're going to take it. And then you're going to go and you're going to walk out and you're going to click the, you know, the Men in Black little thingamabob, right? And have to take a vacation from thinking about it, which is, I know, easier.
Which is the work. I mean, that's the other part of the work. You know, the work is the technical work and the training and being a good actor and preparing. But I think the less spoken about part until more recently is the mindset side of, but how do you sustain that in your mm-hmm. life? There's acting and then there's your life. And it's sort of like the bigger part feeds into your acting, right? And if you're having a terrible blinkered life, there's only so much you can come.
Oh no, I'm a firm believer, you know, it's that mind body connection and the, you know, mental health connection that's in, you know, that it should be for all of us. But if you've got blinders on and that's the only thing you're focusing on, you're gonna be fucked. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a hard way just to live your life in general, and especially for actors where you have, you know, you don't have control over a lot of things. You just don't. That's just, it's part of the game, mm-hmm. right? You go in, you do great work, and you might've been the best one, but you still might not get the role because of, you know, any one of 50 different reasons. So that whole idea to be able to say, you know, I'm working on my craft, I'm coming in, I'm doing the best work that I can do. I'm bringing, you know, my version of this role. You know, I'm bringing my authentic self and my authentic work to this role. And then I got to call it a day and move on and do something that makes me happy for the rest of the day. You know, something that keeps me creatively, you know, juiced, whether it's that, you know, I like to run, so I go and I stress run, right? Or whether you like to write music, or whether you like to write, or whether you like to bake, or whatever the thing is that just keeps the momentum happening. Because if your momentum is only from audition to audition to audition, you know, that's, you're setting yourself, that's like your mind is just, you know, it's not.
And if you have those breaks sometimes between auditions, then you're going to be just not healthy. It's a bad recipe for all kinds of stuff.
And it isn't just like the, you know, the positivity and those, you know, the other, you know, creative vibes that you're trying to keep the fires burning. It's also the, you know, it's like actors tend, you know, can get lazy. It's like athletes have to practice. They got to go to work out. Musicians have to practice. And actors sometimes don't practice. Actors sometimes don't get in there, whether it's an acting class, whether it's an improv class, whether it's, you know, meeting with friends and, you know, putting together a web series, something that is like part of the creative like the not just the mental health part of it and the things that make you happy, mm-hmm. but something that's working towards your craft. Something that's, you know, actively, you know, in the wheelhouse.
Well, the accountability of doing that takes the pressure off, because you're not then, I mean, I found anyway, by starting doing your own stuff, making your own work, you don't, it's not that you don't care about the auditions. It's that you can let go of them more readily, because you know that, well, but next week I'm going to film something anyway. Okay, it's not going to be on HBO. Well, maybe. But it's it's your own chance to express and to your point, keep the tools sharp, because I think the worst thing would be, you know, the Olympic athlete that's not trained and then goes to the Olympics after 4 years and then they break down on the first sprint. It's the same for us. If we don't do anything for 6 months and come into our first audition, we're probably going to suck.
Right. And it isn't just like the sharpening of the tools, but it's like, it's the mental sharpness. It's the, you know, everything gets fuzzy. I get fuzzy too. If I haven't been working for a while, I'm like, oh my God, I forgot how to work. I forgot how I'm gonna have to go in the room and be with my clients. And I have to, I don't remember what was the actor's name. You know, I'll get fuzzy and foggy when we're not sort of doing our thing, but you just don't want to go too far down that road, because then the recovery period can kill you, and you have to sort of be, you have to be at the ready on, you know, on the top of your game to go in when you get those 5 minutes in the room. Sure. Right. When you win that seat, when you earn, you know, you earn your place in the room. Cause I always say, you know, I'm an independent casting director and I don't work for a studio or network. And, you know, we have to do the same thing that you do. There's less of us. It's true. And when we go into meet on a project, they usually bring in three. It's just the rule of three. And it took me a while to sort of wrap my head around the fact, I'm like, why? Good ideas, like, you know, why didn't I get that job? I vibed with those guys. We were laughing, we were in it, and like, you know, and I have to take my own advice. It's like I earned my seat in the room,
sure,
right? And for whatever reason, right, they didn't, you know, they didn't think my jokes were funny, or, you know, we're all going to come in with the same general kinds of ideas, or the same, you know, casting directors who are kind of in it and sort of current on what's happening. There's going to be some crossover on the ideas that are going to come in, but it's about sort of, okay, who do they want to sit in the room with for a day? Who do they think gets their vision? And maybe I'm not the right person. Maybe I, you know, didn't, you know, maybe they don't think I was inside their head enough, and that's okay. You know, on to the next.
And to your point, you know, you're a shade of green, but maybe they want a slightly different shade of mm-hmm. the same color palette. And so it's not that you're not right in the wheelhouse. Okay. It's just.
Yeah. And it's okay. And can't take it personally, even though it feels personal.
Yeah. But that's the kind of sort of duality aspect of everything. But that must've taken you, I mean, a while to get to that, or did you always have that approach? Like,
didn't always have that approach.
I was going to say, what was there a moment where you can remember where you had a clear switch, or was it a bit more organic?
You know, after one that really hurt.
Right. Yeah. Right? Ironic after, how that happens.
After one that really hurt, I'm like, and it was like, why, you know, I'm going to have to let that go. I was pissed off. I felt entitled, and, you know, I didn't understand. And like, you know, what are they talking about?
What do they know?
Get my Emmy and stick it on the table, right? But it, you know, I had to, you know, put my grown-up pants on and say, you know, and give and take my own advice. What I've been telling actors for years, you know, drop it at the door, leave it at the door, right?
And I love that little part about it where you mentioned take your Emmy and put it on the table, just because if anyone listens, no, but that shows the fact that, not to disparage the Emmy, which is an amazing fucking achievement, but it's also that it doesn't apply necessarily to a new project with a blank slate. Yeah, so
it does not.
It's always evolving. And that's the same
with all of it. Yeah. It's the same with actors. It's the same with casting directors or, you know, cinematographers or, you know, whatever. You're only as good as your last project, or you're only as, you know, like memory fades, or, you know, it also keeps you stuck. Mm. Right. If that's where my head is and I'm going to live in that self-righteous, you know, I think actors get into that. It's like, well, I did this and I did that and I deserve this and I deserve that. I'm like, no, you don't. You have to, it is evolving, and it's not,
I guess it's more that space for growth that you don't mm-hmm. allow to be there. Right.
Right. Sure. And that, I mean, that takes, you know, that takes patience, that takes time, that takes maturity. It takes, you know, learning to sort of live with the, live with the pain, you know, or finding a way to, you know, work your way around it and say, all right, what could I have done differently? You know, that's what I do. And I examine, I'm like, did I blow that meeting? Like, I have to look at myself really hard, not for self-punishment, because actors don't need any more of that. Actors are the worst at, you know, walking out the door, oh, I sucked, and, you know, getting into
never going to work, you know, again. Oh yeah, all that
inner voices, the inner negativity.
But that's what Twitter's for these days, Debbie. That's all Twitter is. Twitter's just, yeah, our inner monologue, just there, it's for poison. Everybody to see.
Instagram's healthier. You could just, you know.
I mean, they're both not great. They're both not great, but sure, I'm with you. All right, Debbie, I see that I've got Wallace in the waiting room, so I'm going to bring him in and give you a little break from me and let him have a bit of time.
With cool. You.
And hopefully he's got his video set and his audio ready and tech works. There we go.
Hey.
Hello.
Good morning, or good evening, as the case may be.
Good evening, Wallace.
Evening, in this case. Good yeah. Evening. Hey.
I'm going to leave you to it, Wallace. I'll let you have a bit of a chat, have 5-10 minutes. I'll just sit here quietly.
Great. All right.
That's unlikely, Debbie. I don't know if you're familiar with Ashley, but he'll chip in.
Thank you.
Got to call it like it is. Debbie, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
I have questions for you with regards to kind of self-taping, if that's all right. I'm sure it's nothing that you haven't been asked before. But I realize that there's a lot of things that we, from our side of the fence, kind of take for granted or have assumptions about, mm-hmm. that where we actually, we don't have any clarity in real life. So, like, I was actually kind of wondering if we could talk about the life cycle of a self-tape and how it travels through the system to end up where it does, and how you guys categorize them as you go through them. Thank you.
You know, it kind of, you know, it depends on the turnaround for something, but let's just say I'm casting a series and I've asked for self-tapes because, not because I'm lazy and I don't want an actor come into my room, but because, you know, there's a time crunch or it's something that, you know, it's COVID and we have to have people, you know, go on for self-taping. So I'm going to set it up with your agent or manager. If you don't have one, I'll set up directly with you. And if we do set up directly, then you'll have contact with somebody in my office. We'll probably relay a couple of pieces of information about where we're starting, the tone, you know, whatever information I have that would be helpful to you. You tape it. I asked, when people are self-taping, I usually ask for a couple of takes, just because maybe you have an idea that I didn't, maybe you, you know, I feel like it's a healthy thing to do. Right. I mean, I watched the second take. I'm going to be honest. If the first take was good, I'm going to go, let me see what the second was. And if it was like, oh no, I like the first one better, I will never watch them all the way through. It's just to give me a choice.
But will you always watch at least one of the takes all the way through? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's a really long scene and it's just not right.
Right.
If it's just not right. But the same holds true for, you know, for a taped audition that holds true in the room. If it's good, you know, I'm going to like stick it in another little file or a palm and go, oh, not here. But, you know, this is like this is an actor I don't want to forget.
Right? Oh, nice.
This is somebody I don't want to forget. This is somebody I like. And I jot down, you know, I might jot down a couple of vague notes about where the person might fit in. Good for lawyers, good for cops, whatever, just so that I can, you know, remember as I'm pulling, you know, somebody out of my hat later. You know, we will get, I don't set up that many people. I don't set up 25 people for a role because we're really careful about the choices that we make about people that are coming into the room. I don't want to go through 25 auditions because I'm going to edit before I get people in the room, whether I'm going to be careful. I'm going to have watched somebody's demos. You know, if there's somebody that I didn't know, I'm maybe going to have a piece of information. Maybe I saw them in a play. Maybe it's something the agent talked about. Maybe I saw them on something else. So I'm not experimenting, you know, that far. So I would say for a role, if it's a series regular or something like that, there are a lot of people who are self-taping. if it's a guest lead on something, I'm not bringing in 20 people.
Right.
I'm gonna curate my session, and I'm gonna have people who I know are good actors, who I think are in the wheelhouse, I'm going to see them and I will, you know, I may cut people, right? Oh, they didn't get this role. Oh, that's not right. Oh, it feels, oh, I was wrong. This just feels too young, or any number of reasons why I might decide not to, you know, send that person on. But then, you know, we're going to put it in our, you know, in my cyber session that I'm sending to the producers and the directors. And what I would like to be doing in the room would be to talk about like, oh, this person, they were, you know, they had a great take on the sign. It was really funny, or, you know, all those comments. I probably give a little bit of editorial when we're sending the session, not too much, because I want them to view it fresh too. And depending upon how much they've told me about the role, which sometimes is not much at all, I might think, wow, and like these three would be my first choices, but I'm not quite sure that that's really where their head is. So I want them to view it clean, you know? Right. And again, when somebody comes into the room, I'm not like saying, this is my favorite choice. I don't really do that. It's sort of the kiss of death. But I talk about, you know, oh my God, I just saw them on, you know, an episode of The Undoing, that Nicole Kidman thing, they played XYZ. That's my job, is to create some excitement. It's to also create a comfortability level, like that person's working, that person's doing, you know, it's sort of the psychological part of some of what we do when we're, you know, in the room with people. But so we do a little bit of that in cyberspace, and then we send it around, and we send it around, and the voting begins online. And depending upon how many people are taking a look at it, some voices matter more than others, right? In television, the producer is king, you know, the writer producer, and in a film, the director is king. And so they'll make their selects and their choices, and they'll hopefully get some consensus about, you know, who they like. And, you know, then if we all come up with the same one, then we say, great, that's who we want to hire. And then we have to send it onto the studio and the network for their approval. Usually we don't get kickback on that by that point, not too much, but sometimes we do for no particular reason or not a good reason. Or, you know, he looks too much like the guy that's, you know, like their opinion starts to, you know, their own personal opinion, like I was talking about before, like this, the filter of, oh, I don't think they look like a whatever lawyer. And it becomes like the subjective part of it. It's like, you know, that's the hard part about sending off choices to people who haven't been in the room to see how we got to the place we got to.
Right.
Right. The evolution of why this person, and then, you know, then we make our case. Well, we feel, you know, and then we give, you know, our arguments, or the producers, directors, you know, give their arguments as to why this is where we are, why this is the choice we made. And hopefully they agree. So that's where it ends up. So even if it doesn't, you know, we don't save everything. I don't save all the self-tapes. You know, there's not enough storage in the world for it. But, you know, we keep notes just like we would, you know, in the room about, you know, our session. And so, you know, if you weren't right for one thing and you might be right for another, then, you know, you'd be back in my office or in cyberspace at some other mm-hmm. point. Did that answer your question?
Honestly, like, you kind of blow my mind. I love that, because there are things like that I hadn't even considered. So I hope that's going to be of use to other people hearing that as well. Because, you know, like, it is from our perspective, we're like, we send the tape off, and we're like, that's the best tape I've ever done. And then you're like, they haven't called yet. This is so weird. And then weeks go by and you're like, no, I'm still in with a shot, surely.
My husband is an actor too.
Right.
So I hear about it.
You're familiar.
I have to talk him down off the ledge about things, you know, and especially about, you know, self-taping. I just helped him with a tape the other day. Sometimes he doesn't like me to help him because he says I'm too harsh. I'll stop in the middle of take. I'm like, no, that one wasn't right. Why didn't you let me finish? Because I'm not going to use that one anyway.
Right.
I wouldn't do that in the room.
When you, under normal circumstances where people were coming into the room, when you were you making, if you saw a performance in the room that you weren't at the time sold on, would you ever go check the tape afterwards to see if it looked different on camera that somehow?
Yeah, we were talking about that before you were on, because the room is like, it's the starting point. It's a great tool. I like the immediacy of it. I can see, we generally read with actors in our office. I don't use a reader because I like to be right there, and I can tell when you're telling the truth. But, you know, the whole part of the audition where somebody comes in and they do this work, and then it's just like somebody might be off, right? It just might be off. And I will stop somebody if they're in it. I'll go, oh, no, 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 way too hot. Because I can tell. I'm not going to sit through the scene if they're already starting there. Right. But sometimes people, you know, somebody will come in and they'll do good work, and I want to see if they can take the direction, you know, and or I'm not sure kind of where they're really going to land on a particular scene. If it is like it happens, you know, scenes, you know, that have a lot of anger, a lot of volatility, you know, I don't know sometimes how far they will take that. So I might want to experiment and just see how it feels in the room. And then, you know, sometimes I find my own answer. I'm like, oh, no, it doesn't work when it's, you know, it's that hot, or it needs a little bit more. And a little bit more juice. So when somebody comes in, and if they're not quite right for the role and they've done good work, you know, that's what I had talked about earlier too. I'm going to remember them. I'm going to, you know, that's my job to be able to go back and, you know, do that. And sometimes I will tell people in the room, I'll go, oh my God, I'm really going to remember you. I don't think you're not right here. Right. I'm going to burst your bubble right here so that you cannot walk out of the door thinking that you didn't. When you don't get a call back, then you're not going to be kicking yourself. All right. And that's just, you know, that's just me. That's just my office. I always like to say the opposite of what I say may also be true, because it, you know, I'm only talking about, you know, sort of my barometer and how we do it in our office. You know, you ask 10 different casting directors, you know, how they do it, you might get 10 different answers, not about kind of the basics, but about how they run their office. Did I answer your question? I didn't really, did I?
Yeah, no, you did. So I also saw that you cast Insatiable, which just phenomenal show. So bravo to you. But with I think this is fascinating for me, because I'm very lucky. I get to go for a very wide range of things. But it's always interesting when you come across a script like that, which you can see will be quite theatrical in the way that it's, you know, like, you know, obviously the truth is all there, but those performances are not by any stretch of the imagination, like tiny nuanced performances. Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated by, you know, it's so a la mode at the moment for everything to be so like toned down and pared down and naturalistic. Mm-hmm. And you often get that note when you're reading something that really feels like the final product is going to be quite big. And I was just wondering how you navigate that, especially with actors in the room who might go too hot or too small.
Right. I mean, that's funny you mentioned that project. That was probably one of the hardest projects to start, because you read it. I'm like, oh, there's so many ways this could go wrong, because it was broad and it was big and it was campy. But then if you lean into the camp, you're going to be dead. It's just like, it's not going to ring true. There's not going to be any emotional content to it. Cause then there were these sweet emotional moments. And that was really a tough one, especially the lead character that was like a beauty pageant director.
Right.
Turned beauty pageant director based on a real guy.
Oh, no way.
Based on a real guy. Look him up. Bill, I can't remember his last name, Alvis. He was a real, real guy in the South who was an attorney and then coached beauty pageants. In a reality show for a couple of years. It was a New York Times article about him. That's how the series was born.
Oh my gosh.
But, you know, when sometimes we have to figure out how it lives too, and like where, you know, where it's going to sit and what's going to be the best way. And so, you know, that was our note for a lot of people to say, you know, be careful of the camp, right? Because there, I mean, like you read that script and it's full of minefields. Right. It just that one in particular. There's just I was like, oh my God, this could be deadly. It's like you have to like tonally have to be very, very careful. And also we had to figure out, you know, where it was really gonna land tonally. So for actors, I think, you know, for us, we were constantly kind of like telling people, you know, don't do this, do this, because it was so unclear to us, and you know how it would best work, that we wanted to give that information to the actors. So I tell actors, you know, when they're coming in, especially when you're creating something out of whole cloth, whether it's like a movie or it's a pilot, it's something that doesn't exist, it's a universe you can't go and watch an episode of, it's a book you can't read to gain any more information, you know, we're all in there trying to figure it out together, right? And some in it kind of sometimes it changes and it evolves as you're going through the process, or you find out what the best way is. But if there's a universe that already exists, you need to you know, it's part of your prep. Watch an episode. Right. If you don't have Apple, you know, TV, then go and Google the teaser, something.
Right.
You know, find out as much as you can, because especially with comedy, you know, the tone of it is, you know, is it like Veep comedy or is it like Modern Family? You know, those are two really different things. Or is it like, you know, multicam? You know, you have to be careful. If you go in there and you think you're auditioning for, you know, so I love Veep, so if you haven't watched it, it might not make sense.
I love
that comedy, like that real under, and like they say these jokes, it's like it's all this walk and talk, and these, and it's not, it is very specific in its tone. So it would be, you know, deadly to come in and play it really broad and, you know, for laughs and theatrical, even though the lines are funny. You know, they're funny as hell, but just to understand the world in which you're trying to go and be a part of. You know, and I mean, it's funny because that's true for drama too.
So I'm just thinking with Veep specifically, it's funny because also like you do have these like stand-up performances from like Gary or Mike McClintock that are actually quite broad in their own way, like physically are quite over the top, but they do somehow seamlessly work within that because I guess they're it's like the paintbrush, it's just a highlight, isn't it?
Right. And, you know, to go back, I just feel like when there is something in general that's kind of, that's big, that's kind of broad, if it's already there in the writing, I'm always a fan of sort of letting the words do the work for you. If you put too much gas on top of something that is already this heightened reality or this really, you know, super theatrical thing, it's generally too much.
Right.
It's sort of a matter of degrees about where you choose to, you know, hit it a little harder or, you know, to find the tone of it. Comedies are harder to do that with than drama. Drama's a little bit easier, you know, but even something like, you know, 24 for Years, and that had like, it had a rhythm. Everything was fast and low and under, and there was a lot of that.
You did that really well.
I sat through a lot of those auditions. But then, you know, like Aaron Sorkin has a very, you know, it's a language,
right
it's a whole way, it's a pattern of speech, it's you know, it's the speed of it, it's, you know, it's very, very specific. You can usually tell Aaron's writing, and to be able to sort of know what you're coming in for, if it's something that's being created out of, you know, it's something that hasn't existed before, and to pick your brains of your reps to see, you know, how much information they can give you. And if the casting office is good, you know, we're going to be updating, you know, sort of the reps and the people that we're talking to, you know, in real time about what works and what doesn't. Because it does change, and we don't always know. You know, we're, like I said, we're getting our barometer too. And the more people that come in, we see the things that, like, oh my God, everybody's making that one choice. It's not something in the slug lines of, you know, the writers. I say, you know, writers forget sometimes that actors are going to read all the stage directions. And so when they use a word, you know, I call them spice words, right? Like violently or, silent scorn or whatever those things are. I mean, because that's what you're looking for. You're looking for those nuggets to hold on to so you can figure out how to play it. And that's why I always call them spice words, because they're usually just spice and they're not the whole, they're not the whole dish.
I had one yesterday. I was taping yesterday, and they, for one of the lines, my character is apparently hyperventilating. And I was like, but nothing else other than the fact that they put it in parentheses. Like there was nothing else in the scene that implied that he was hyperventilating. And I was like, we're just going to bypass that because I don't have a brown paper bag with me.
Right. And you can always ask too, because, you know, sometimes if there's something that's really throwing people off that's in the slug lines or in a description or whatever, we'll say, you know, we don't really mean that. Even though I know it says that here, don't do it.
Right.
Or, you know, we found that, you know, again, it's if 20 people come in and do the same thing, it's like, oh, there is something in the writing. There is something that people are being led down this road to. And that's how scripts change too. Like, the writer will sometimes look at it and go, oh, that, you know, it's not clear here. This transition, you know, no actor can remember the next line after this because the transition's not right. There's not this piece that's going to logically take them from one, you know, one thought to the other.
Yeah. I have a final question, if you don't mind.
No.
And it was, Ashley and I probably have similar experiences with this, is we're multilingual, so there's often these instances where we're taping or auditioning for things in a foreign language. So I speak fluent Arabic, for example, and I'll often tape for things. And I get so wrapped up in trying to, because Arabic has so many different dialects, and trying to get the correct dialect for you guys and all these things. And you often end up seeing somebody's been cast in the role who has obviously learned Arabic on the day, you know, on set, and it's kind of like glued the words together. And it's a real minefield for us when we're doing it. And I just wonder, like, where you guys sit, and I know these things are contingent on budget to a certain extent, but, you know, do you have somebody watch something with you when you don't speak the language? Or do you rely on the actor's resume and him saying that he or she saying that they are a fluent speaker?
I don't rely on it, because, you know, it's like the old adage, like, yeah, I can ride a horse. And like everybody who's ever said that in a Western, it's like, no, you couldn't. It's, you know, you needed to go to, you know, horse riding camp, which they do in Westerns a lot of times, because it is a skill, right? And it's interesting because I have been on shows. I mean, 24 was that, you know, and we did not always succeed at it. And we had to learn to get better at, you know, I there wasn't anybody on staff who was helping us. So I would call, I had a couple of actor friends, and I'm like, they could be saying this and it could be the worst accent on the planet. I don't know. It's not my language. I don't really, I'm not going to hear whether it's right or wrong, or if somebody's mispronouncing a word. Now you can be coached, and it can be something. It's just like in a medical show, I call it the MBS, the medical bullshit, right? You can learn how to say those words, and neurothrombosis and whatever, that happens all the time in the language of a show, legal terms, medical terms, you know, cop terms, whatever. Speaking a language, which I have no, you know, basis and knowledge of, and a lot of the time the writer, you know, may not have knowledge of, you know, what they're necessarily trying to ask, you know, an actor to do. It may not be the wording of it. You know, so we're having to, you know, put, you know, safeguards and trying to learn as much as we can too, so that we're not doing it wrong.
Right.
Right. You know, hopefully, I mean, we did, and as time went on, you know, I had sort of a go-to bunch of people, and, you know, I developed a little bit of an ear myself, but also just to say, I don't know, I have to ask. I want to make this real. And, you know, the producers and writers want to make it realistic, and they want to make it too. So insofar as the auditions themselves, I mean, you know, my friend that was helping me with this stuff, he would say, well, this dialect is, you know, in this part of the country, and those, you know, those, it's like a very working class kind of thing. It would be the difference between Cockney and, you know, like the posh British accent. And we just have to rely on somebody who knows better than me. I'm not going to pretend to know. And so as an actor, to be able to say, you can help educate, right? I mean, I welcome that. And I would say most people would, to be able to say, you know, this is what it's going to sound like, you know, this is, or here's two different versions, you know, and this being the more, you know, like saying the working class version or whatever. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. And actually, it's just made me consider something, like, so if you're watching a tape in, say, Farsi, and you obviously don't speak Farsi, do you, if you watch it through once, and how are you evaluating it? Like, are you looking very much at like screen technique at that point without you knowing?
I'm looking at, if I'm understanding what's happening without understanding the language, then there's a good chance that it's probably, you know, again, I can't hear, I don't understand whether the inflection is right, or I may not understand, but I'm going to get a vibe about what's happening here. What am I feeling from you not knowing the language? So then I'm going to rely on a different part of my intuition, and I'm going to have to pay attention to that. And then I'm going to have someone else tell me, was that good? Was that, you know, I think it was good. I'm just relying on the emotional cues and the visual cues, and the, you know, I can tell the person is angry. I can tell this is what's happening. And then to, you know, whether it's really, you know, nuanced in terms of the, what the scene is trying to be, you know, to serve the dialogue, really, I'm going to have somebody else help me.
That's fascinating. But that probably explains why there are people who do end up, who don't speak the language, booking the part. And it's purely because they're doing ticking every other box, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah. And the language is almost irrelevant in a sense, right?
Yes. If there's a show, I can think of like Homeland is another one where, you know, if it's set in a particular world, you're going to hope that you have some go-to people so you can vet what it is you're putting on screen, you know, so that I can bring the right people in so that I'm not going to give them choices. I'm like, if I don't know, the producers may not know, then we shouldn't be doing that blindly. It's just a little bit more, you know, it's for us to do our homework and, you know, for actors to be able to speak up and say, you know, this wouldn't really, you know, I mean, actors would come in and say, you know, that's not really right. Like, right. Oh, tell me in the room. I mean, it's different when you have the producers, the directors in there, there's a time for it. But I welcome that because, you know, we want it to be real and truthful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. This was fascinating. Genuinely
nice
appreciate
to speak
it.
With you. Good luck.
Thank
Sleep
you.
Well over there. Stay safe.
I will. Thank you. Thank you, Ash, for having me on. Much appreciated.
My
Bye, guys.
Pleasure. Bye. Godspeed.
Bye.
See you later. Just on that note around the accents as well, before I bring in Chris, we were talking about languages. What about people who don't maybe speak English as their native tongue and you bring them in as, say it's a Latino guy and he's supposed to speak in English, but with a Hispanic accent or flavor?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a subtle hint of that, or do you want them to just do it as truthfully and authentically as they would in real life? Because some accents can be quite strong when they're spoken in English.
You know, I mean, it's like when people are, you know, should I come in if I'm Australian, should I come in Australian or should I come in British? And I think, you know, part of it is that the work we're doing with the reps beforehand to say, it doesn't matter. And, you know, I know that you've got an English accent, you've got an Australian accent, it's fine. This person doesn't matter. We're not saying that they grew up in the same country. It has no bearing. Or I'll say, no, this person is definitely on an American accent. This is the way it has to be. I mean, the truth of the matter is that, again, it comes down sometimes to like a dialect, and like not all English accents are the same, or, you know, is this person sound like they're from El Salvador? They sound like they're from Guatemala? Do they sound like they're from Mexico City? So, you know, it just becomes sort of incumbent on us to help be the gateway and sort of monitor some of that so that we're trying to get truthful representation and something that is authentic. So, but I always tell actors, you know, if you speak in, you know, it, English is not your first language. And if I need you to do an American accent, but I know you have another one, I'll say, you know, I need to do an American accent. This is what this particular role is, you know, it's called for. And then, you know, after that, it, you know, we just kind of, you know, if somebody, people will come in all the time and you know, in a room with producers and, you know, they've asked for it to be, you know, an English, you know, an American accent. And then they'll say, oh, good day, whatever. And they go, I said, do you want them to, you know, I like to not tell beforehand, just because I feel like that worm gets in someone's head and like, oh, they're listening for the mistake. They're listening for it. So if my team doesn't know, I usually don't say. I have the actor come in as they, you know, are supposedly, you know, what they want. And then I'll, you know, they'll say, oh my God, could you just do it in your natural accent? Because there's always, it's a hard thing I know there's another level of work that happens, and generally people are more free when they're doing it in their native accent, generally.
I guess it lets you see them just one less thing to think about with how they're formulating the words.
Yeah, sometimes it takes something, it makes the performance a little bit more stiff. You're trying to do something, it depends on how proficient somebody is too.
Sure.
How much they're having to think about it.
Absolutely. Awesome. All right. Let me bring in Chris for a bit of a chat with you, and then we'll circle back and wrap this up. Because poor Chris, I think, has been waiting a little longer than I told him. Hello, sir. Headphones on. Headphones at the ready.
Hey. How
you guys, Chris?
Good. Good evening.
Good evening. Yeah. What time is it where you're at?
11:03 a.m. I think we're back to where we were because we had our time change. And
yeah. Back to eight hour difference between hours. You guys in here. All right, Chris, I'm going to shut up. I'm going to give you 5-10 minutes to just chat away with Debbie and you know the deal. You know how it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Debbie, I've done one of these with Ash before, and I think it's a great format. I finally had a chance to look at a few of them, which has been really fun. We had a great discussion with Richard Hicks, who I adore. He does some great work.
Richard, he's the real deal. He's a good one.
Oh, yeah, I think you're the real deal, too. Thank you very much. as a matter of fact, I'm going to start with this one because obviously, you know, I looked you up and made sure that I knew some things about you. And I found a gem, Picket Fences.
Oh wow.
I grew up with that as a kid. Sorry, I'm half American. I'll run you through my CV in a sec. But
you've been living there a long time, if you said CV.
Yeah, I've been, I'm an army brat. You know, my dad came over to Germany, married the enemy, and then we moved a lot of places, that kind of thing, you know. but I actually went onto YouTube and checked out some Picket Fences again, because I was like, oh my God, that was a good show.
Picket Fences. It was like one of the first things that I ever cast, you know, that was my project. And that one's near and dear to my heart. I love that show. It was very cool. It was kind of before TV was as cool and hip as it is now. But I'm really proud of that. I love that show.
I think that might be a lockdown rewatch. I think if now that I have some time again.
Could be. Here, you know, let's see how it aged.
Yeah, of course. Because I mean, like, this was, when was that? Is that 95? Is that right?
Wasn't it early 90s?
Early 90s, yeah.
It started in 92 or 93. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would have been, you know. 14,
I 16. Was 10.
Yeah. Of course you were. And then, of course, the other big one, that's 24, which I heartily adore. I mean, and working with some fabulous characters. There was actually once, I did a play in Bruges, and we had 2 days off, and I think it was like season 5 that we watched back to back in 24 hours. So, yeah, it was good.
It's a good way to watch it.
I think it is. I really do. I'm going to talk about myself in a second, just so you know who I am. But what I really loved about Ash's show, and the thing, I'm going to try something different today, Ash, just talk about general casting processes, because I tend to find that these Zoom meet and greets, they tend to veer quite quickly towards actors' angst and stuff like that. And I think actually talking about processes is probably a lot more interesting to see how things work on a day-to-day level. So me, I'm half American, half German. I've worked only in Europe. I've never worked in the United States. I found myself, I started out in theater a lot, and I was a professional singer, training musician. So I actually toured Germany doing top 40 cover gigs and stuff like that for some people over there, and then fell into acting at university. I was studying music, and the music group wasn't very good, quite frankly. And so I walked to my teachers and said, can I do this acting thing instead? Because it looks fun. And they went, well, you can do both. And so they let me do that, which was great.
Yeah.
And then I came out and started auditioning, and that was it, really. I'm kind of at a level where I do a decent amount of walk-on parts. I've had a very small part on Dumbo, and things like Angel Has Fallen has just come out and stuff like that. So I tend to pick up some of the American work that comes over here from Hollywood. I've never worked in Hollywood myself. So. And then tend to make my money doing commercials. I did a Mr. Clean ad. I'm actually re-editing my show right now because that's a bit old right now. And so that's the rough state of me. I started in theater, then, you know, working mainly in television and film at the moment. I was just out today with a good buddy of mine, very good actor, by the way, worth checking out. His name is Clifford Samuels.
That's generous of you. Nice. Give your actor friend a plug.
We're all friends. Yeah, it's fine. and he actually gets offered quite a lot better and bigger things than me, but he was actually talking about something that's been really interesting to us, which is now that a lot of auditions happen over Zoom, what tends to happen versus walking into the room is that we start with self-tapes, is that you get the self-tape and you get a character description and, you know, in a rough scene. But what we don't get, or very, very few times get, is that initial chat when you walk into the room with a director or a casting director, where you get a bit of an idea of the arc. And so the question that I have for you about this is, what we found is that we play these scenes, but don't really have a flavor of what the shooting style is going to be like, of what the director, you know, kind of is seeing in his mind. And so today he got asked in for a recall to reshoot some things. And he was on a Zoom chat with the casting director and the director, who directed him into a scene and suddenly made a lot more sense. So my question to you is, how, when you get self-tapes now, and when you see that the actor just isn't getting the flavor of how the shoot goes, do you go back and ask for a retake? Do you offer some advice on how they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of talking about that a little bit earlier, and it, you know, self-taping in a vacuum is really hard. You know, you can't, you know, the things, the questions that you would ask in the room, you're not necessarily, you get a chance to do that. Maybe you can get one question in through your agent or manager before you actually, you know, get to do the self-tape, which I advocate if you can get any other additional information. I would, you know, not be shy about asking, you know, the office or have your reps, you know, get that for you, because it's just going to help you do better work. I mean, what we try to do, you know, and in this time or whenever I'm asking anybody to do a self-tape, I will give them as much information as I know, as much as I can. Right. If I see that there's something in the description or in, you know, in a particular stage direction that might send somebody off into, you know, a crazy direction or something that maybe has been misinterpreted in other readings, you know, we'll say, it's like, it's not like a, you know, it's what I would say. Like, it's not a trick thing. I don't want to direct somebody and tell them too much about what it is I want them to do, because I want to see what you're going to do. Right. It's not like, oh, I want, I'm going to set you up to fail, so I'm going to tell you nothing, but I want to see what you're going to do. Right. I want your spin on what this is. But the hard part too, is that you don't get to ask the questions that, you know, that might not be apparent just from, you know, the scene. And, you know, especially with things being watermarked now and in the secrecy surrounding scripts, I know that actors are getting, you know, complete scripts less and less. And so any kernel of information then that we can give to people, you know, we're going to try to give that to you ahead of time. And then, you know, most of the time, if it's something that's substantial, you know, I'm probably going to ask for a couple of takes, just because I don't have the ability to do it in real time if somebody's just doing a self-tape. And I may, if there were, a different direction that, you know, we might see somebody, you know, taking a little bit more time with it, or a little bit more humor, or whatever it is. I'm probably not going to ask for two wildly different takes on it, but, you know, some variations that might give me, you know, a chance to better see what the actor could do, or I'm not going to do it in, you know, give a weird direction just because, but something that, you know, that the scene really supports. But yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's a hard thing for now. And so, you know, the more information that you can get, and, you know, it also, it becomes part of the homework of, you know, doing the research that you always did, but having to dig a little bit deeper. Like, if you're coming in and it's an episode of something, you got to watch it.
Yeah.
Right. Or find out the information, or read a piece of the book, or whatever the thing is, that's just going to help you. Or, you know, if you don't know, you know, what's the director done before, what's their vibe. Any piece of information that you can, that's just going to help you try to figure out, I talk about like the world that you're going to come and be a part of. Until we are out of, you know, COVID, this is going to be happening, you know, for a while. And I advocate, you know, actors asking the questions. I mean, if it's coming through your rep, I mean, my husband is an actor too, right? He got something. It was a commercial audition. And they had all these instructions. There were a lot. Wow. And I'm like taping him, like, I have to do this and like tape you. And like, wow, this is very, very specific. And that, you know, that's great. But when there's not that, you're kind of left to your own devices and, you know, going with your gut on it. But if you can get in touch with an office and there's something, it's just like I always say that, you know, when actors come into my office and, you know, we're in the real world, I'm like, I usually say, do you have any questions? Now, it's not, you don't have to have a question. It's not mandatory, but you might have one, right? You know, it might, you know, and there are such things as stupid questions. You know, if, you know, it's like, what's the relationship here? And it says sister, right? It says it, you know, but is it meaningful? You know, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to tell you how to play it. I don't want to give too much because
you want to see what we do first.
Yeah. I want, like, you might have a better idea, right? That's like, you're going to put your own stamp on this. It's going to be filtered through, you know, the choices that you've made. So yeah, I keep talking myself back to the same point, which is that it is hard. you know, and it is not optimum. And, you know, the more information that you can get, you know, the better, and, you know, to advocate. And because it's, you know, I'm not always clear, not all writing is Shakespeare. I mean, there may not be a lot of clues there for you, and it may not be apparent. But to go back to the breakdown and to read it and look at it and see if there's anything you can get from that, or, you know, and I give sometimes like the page, you know, in scenes, we'll try to give the page before, so you can see what happened just before, you know, if you haven't had a chance to read the script. And it's not because I want to waste paper or anything like that. It's because I'm trying to set up the scene for you so you can see, you know, what happened. I know. Yeah. This is a tough time.
I think you've answered a lot of those things really phenomenally. And obviously, you know, we get to see one take. We get to see the one that we do. And I've worked for casting offices before. And that's the reason, that's one of the things I always love to add is, there's no better experience than watching tapes and watching other people do stuff and calling that in and stuff. Got to, you know, for anybody watching this, definitely go intern for a casting office. I was doing that for Sally Broom just this Friday, you know, we were sorting through tapes. It was a great experience. She was casting something for BBC One. And those are great answers because the reason why Cliff and I actually even got about the topic is because he did these phenomenal takes and he got redirected via Zoom by Nina Goldcasting. And there was this person going, look, I see what you've done there. And it's a comedy scene and stuff. But he was very on voice, quick, snappy. It was kind of like House. And they went, no, we actually know further down the line that this guy gets a bit more moody and we want him actually to be a bit of a grumpy, slow stuff. The first scene is meant to be over an operating table. And he was like, okay, well, if you'd have told me that, then great, you know. So it was a phenomenal way to see him progress, but from a very loud on voice tape to something that was almost underplayed, you know, soft spoken, soft voiced. And yeah.
Part of the answer to that, you know, too, maybe like in this world of having to put people on self tape, I'm gonna forgive a lot of things, meaning like if the work is good. And I think it's just not quite right, but all it really is a direction. All it was like, oh, if they, you know, like, oh, that's all this needs. This is just a fix. The actor's good. They're right. It's on time. And so in this time, that's where you might get more of those things where you come in and they might go, okay, I liked what you did, but now I want you to do this, because you didn't have the opportunity to sort of do that in the room with the casting director, or even like if it was the first call, if it's just happening as a self tape. So that probably happens a little bit more now where, you know, you may be bringing people in and I'm not getting to redirect in the room, but I'll say, this is just what it needs. And then, you know, for the call, just like I would for a call back in my office, I'd say, I liked what they did, but when they come in this time, I want them to do X, Y, Z, or I want them to make this tweak. The flip side of that is if you don't get those notes and no changes, then don't make a change.
Fair.
Like that's one of the single most frustrating things that people go, oh, I got a call back. Now I'm going to really work on it and come in and do this. I'm like, oh no, I brought you in because I liked what you did. Don't change it. Don't change it.
Different. Don't. Great. There's a question that I asked Richard Hickson, because you're working in television. I just thought it might be a great thing to ask you as well, because obviously COVID-19, working on film has just become a different beast for now, at least. Hopefully that vaccine comes around. But the question that I asked him and that I'd like to ask you too, just to see whether the answer is different in television, is that, you know, we've heard horror stories of cuts everything down to the main cast, get rid of extras, get rid of cameos, which for me is deadly because I'm a cameo actor. I'm the guy you stand next to the pretty people to make them look good, you know? And all those parts obviously are, you know, make the rich diversity and flavor of what we're doing. On Dumbo, for example, we were working with 300 kids and extras and stuff like that, and we've heard horrible stories about them becoming CGI. What's your experience? Is this happening, or is it?
It is, to the extent that, you know, the things that are coming back and that are filming, you know, they are having to rework. Let's say in a series where you might have other characters come to do some heavy lifting. If they can flip that around and a series regular can sort of take what they were going to do story-wise, they are trying to lessen the number of people that will be on set, but I think it's really only in in a hospital show, let's say, where there's tons of people coming in and out and there's patients and there's this and there's that. I do think that there will be less of the nurses and the paramedics and things like that. There will be less of those for now. Look, line producers, not to diss on line producers, but you know, their favorite thing is to go through the script with their little Sharpie, you know, and cross things out to make the budget work. And the writers are like, oh, I want to see that. I need that reaction. So there's always been the push and the pull of that. And it's really about, I don't think it will stick in a huge way. But yeah, extras, there's going to be some digital extras. There's going to be that. There are going to be more bottle episodes. There's not going to be things on location as much. Things are going to be on sets. That is happening. And I know in writers' rooms, they're trying to figure out how to have their series regulars do more. It's going to be harder an hour, but how to have less people do the same story. So it is happening, but I don't think that it's not going to go away forever. It's just, you know, we're in a place where, you know, they're trying to diminish the amount of people because, you know, safety reasons and also the costs, you know, that COVID is, you know, tacking on to the end of productions is pretty substantial. You know, the tests, the extra personnel, the time, you know, to check, you know, temperatures and make sure that there's COVID break, you know, like these safety breaks and things. So, you know, that is real. And I don't know that it will have a lasting impact because, you know, writers want to write and they want to tell the stories that they want to tell. So I think that there's sort of a temporary, you know, downturn in that. It may impact locations and sort of the extra and the things that they really can do digitally. I don't know. We'll see how much of a hangover, you know, that leaves. But yeah, for the time being, I think people are mindful of, you know, having fewer people on set, you know, in on always, not just from the actors, but in terms of, you know, does that person have to be on set? Is that a job that ever has to be on set again? I probably will never go on a set again, you know, but we just get to visit, but it's not, you know, somebody that really doesn't have to be there. So it's probably not the answer you want to hear for now, but I do, you know,
it's an honest answer. It's actually something that's
real.
It helps us plan. It helps us think about how to approach things. It helps us, quite frankly, for example, I have a very good friend of mine who's just brought out a feature film, which he's been pretty much shooting in his living room. It's called Dune Drifter. It's currently at the, you know, what date is today? Yeah. You can still see it till the 19th on the Leeds Film Festival for Fiverr. And he's done the impossible thing of making a film for £60,000. Wow. And it's a sci-fi and it looks like £2.5 million. And I think right now, the reason I'm saying it is because I said this to Richard as well. There's a real opportunity for young filmmakers and for smaller groups to actually go and make things for themselves because there is a production lag. There is stuff, you know, the big studios right now are not investing into, you know, letting James Bond be on the big screen. So you can actually push those films that, you know, you might want to make yourselves. A friend of mine was in a film called Host, which achieved internet fame and then is now in cinema. Okay. So it's fantastic and on screen. So these are very realistic answers that give us something to work with, actually. Yeah. So I think that's really good.
No, but I think you're right. I think that, you know, I mean, the internet and what's been happening with the crossover and, you know, with comedy, probably more comedy than anything else, but, you know, out of YouTube and whatever, all these things, like, it's the Wild West. Yeah. Anybody with an iPhone and, you know, you can make things and have them seen and make content and do it. I mean, that was happening before the pandemic. And now, I mean, I do think that, like, you know, we adapt, right? And things, there are going to be changes, there are going to be lasting changes in some ways. But I also think, you know, because, you know, one thing, like the vacuum of content, it's like, if there are people who can make things and do it on a shoestring, and, you know, there's a place for things that might not have had a place before now, just because of all of the changes, like, you know, what's going to succeed and what's going to rise. I mean, Quibi, that, you know, that was a big expensive, you know, experiment, and that one didn't work. But
I think that's a really interesting question to you, how you feel about that, because Remember, I told you I was a musician. I grew up in the age when, you know, digital downloads became a thing. And if you look at the devaluing of music, when you look at like the no money that Spotify pays for people listening to hours and hours and hours worth of content, I'm actually a bit worried about this. On the other hand, I find it's created an immense pool of possible you know, beneficial things like Netflix. Netflix is giving thousands and thousands of pounds to small-time filmmakers to create some things. How do you say this from a casting perspective? You know, is this a good or a bad thing that people can make movies on their iPhones?
I mean, I ultimately think it's great. It's leveled the playing field. Okay. But, you know, there's also, there's a lot of dreck too. I mean, there just is. But I don't know. I think that it's leveled the playing field more than anything else. And I'm glad that my job is not at one of the big agencies to weed through, you know, all the YouTube content, or that is, you know, seriously, or to be at a studio or network where my job is to have to go through and sift through all those things. I prefer my corner of the world, that kind of casting. But there, you know, people are out there looking for that stuff and looking for, you know, the next voice as an actor, as a writer, as a filmmaker. And so there's going to be like evolution and change that comes out of, you know, some of the things being squeezed. Okay, there's big, you know, if you have boatloads of money and a big, big film project, those things will get made with their safety bubbles. Yeah. With their, you know, renting out entire cities and hotels and things to be able to do a thing like that. But that it takes, you know, it takes a lot of money and influence. And then there's, you know, television, which is like hugely, I mean, even before the pandemic, and you know, it exploded, like 500 scripted series last year or the last few years. You know, there's no way that anyone can watch it all. I can't, and that's my job. So, you know, the vacuums that get created by like sort of like the mid, you know, these mid budget movies, which were being squeezed anyway, that's hard. You know, the Avengers is a huge commodity. It's going to make bank. It's, you know, there's a built-in audience. They're going to make those movies, you know, the moderately, you know, budgeted movies, especially in this time, you know, that's hard. So then was it, you know, I think indies and sort of this Wild West filmmaking, they'll be the recipient of, you know, whatever benefit comes out of it. That's just me.
No, you've actually just hit on something that I think I find is really interesting, because, you know, you've come from network television all the way into where we are now, which is a phenomenal trajectory when you think about it. And with the advent of H2O and then obviously later streaming services like Netflix, I mean, the change in the way you can make television, because HBO obviously as a private channel was able to introduce swearing and how that moved. But how does that now translate to budgets? Because that's something that we never get a look into. Like, we've seen all these, you know, we see Al Pacino in what is the Netflix thing of the Jewish, the people who were hunting Nazis?
Hunters,
exactly. And, and I mean, these are big budget people. Like, what do the television budgets look like? Like, you know, I don't know.
I think it's a little bit like, you know, big budget movies. You know, they spend a lot of money on a few people or a few things, and then,
yeah, you know, that's a great honest answer.
that is what happens. You know, I don't think, I'm trying to guess, I don't really know what the budget of Hunters would be, but you know, they're not going off on crazy locations. You kind of look at what the template for the series is, like they've got their sets, they've spent some money there, but you know, it's not like things aren't blowing up. There's not huge crowd scenes. They have other ways that there's, you know, any way that they can contain a piece and, you know, like, and do it in 7 episodes or 8 episodes. I mean, that's the thing. That's the biggest piece, I think, too, is that everything is, you know, like 22 episodes. I mean, not many people are, you know, signing up for that anymore. You know, cable and streaming certainly changed the face of, you know, network television here anyway, for sure. I mean, the BBC's been doing that for a long time, limited series, and, you know, it's like nothing new. And, you know, finally kind of getting onto the wave of, you know, that's how people like to watch. People's attention spans, you know, aren't necessarily that long.
Fair. Are you working on anything that's come over here to Europe to shoot, or?
No, I'm okay. not at the moment.
No, I was just curious whether Brexit affected it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think we're not doing so well over here. Maybe, I don't know, the UK isn't either, but you know, before there were, you know, I think that there was the thought that there might be more things that would escape to Europe to shoot because, you know, people were handling it better. Maybe not right at this minute. So I don't know. I mean, you know, we got some pretty lousy news even here in California. It's bad. It's bad. And so I'm really just praying that they don't lock it down again like it was before.
I don't think anything is going to happen in terms of lockdowns till January when you get people in there that are more sensible to make those laws there, right? I mean, you got a couple of
months. Well, we had lockdowns in California, though. You know.
Yeah, because the governor and sure to get out of it. Yeah.
In terms of, you know, there wasn't anything being made at all. Nothing for, wow, you know, several months. They just weren't. And then, you know, once, you know, the numbers got better, but also, you know, SAG was deciding, you know, people were trying to get together and have, what do the protocols look like? What is a safe way to go back and shoot? How are we doing this? And all the unions got together and, you know, came up with these, you know, these guidelines.
See, but this is exactly it. So, and especially here in Britain, the unions are nowhere near as strong as they are in America. But what they found is that they found working processes that they can work with, which is kind of where the questions earlier became interesting about, you know, cutting down people on set and yada, yada. And that's why I kind of asked the question, because obviously a lot of my work comes from American work spilling over here. And with COVID being so prevalent in America, I was wondering whether actually some of the television productions might come over too. And obviously, I mean, I have a European passport, but Brexit is coming too. And, you know, a lot of productions would come. Yeah, I know. A lot of productions would come to Britain, but then, you know, sometimes film in Budapest or film in Paris or something like that. So I was curious to see whether any of that affected you. But
I've somebody I know who's in the crew, like a department head who's doing the Jack Ryan thing. And, you know, she's been flying. They are based in Budapest, but they've been in Rome some. I think they were in the UK for a little bit. And like, you know, she was supposed to do it last summer. You know, the summer didn't happen. And then I think they started up again in early October. So they've been at it for a little while. And I'm like, wow, they're doing it and they're traveling and, you know, their protocols. I mean, the protocols that are in place and, you know, be pretty vetted to have these things. And they do, you know, they'll do spot checks and, you know, you'll have the permission to shoot taken away if it's not, you know, followed seriously. And they will shut you down. It's like, you know, was doing a little bit of work on something, was a video game actually for a really big company. And, you know, they're skeleton crews anyway. It's not a lot of people that, you know, are there. And it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit different. There are already systems in place that allow for a pretty safe, you know, a working environment. But even so, it's like, you know, there's no backup. If somebody, you know, like one of the actors gets sick, it's like, you're gonna have to shut down, you know? Yeah. So it's to everybody's benefit to, you know, you really have to, you know, follow those rules and, you know.
I mean, it's that Robert Pattinson thing, isn't it? Robert Pattinson got ill on Batman and they had to shut the production down. And like, there's a lot of, like, here with Pinewood Studios, Disney's has basically bought Pinewood Studios for the next 10 years. And you know, and when you shut down, that's real money. And the question is, you might not have that studio because somebody else has booked it. So, yeah, it's an interesting.
It'll be interesting to see what happens in January, you know, like for, well, if there's a traditional pilot season, which has been getting weirder for the last few years anyway, because it's year round now anyway, but the networks still follow that model largely. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that everybody wants to be the canary in the coal mine after all the hates here about, you know, what will happen. So we all have to, you know, burn candles and incense and, you know, just hope that, there's a vaccine and hope that people are just going to be smart about it so that, you know, people want to go back to work. People need to go back to work.
Does it still make, I mean, like if COVID weren't a thing, would it still make sense to come out to LA for pilot season?
Yeah, there is still a traditional pilot season and there is, you know, depending upon what the flavor of any particular year is and what the kinds of roles that are happening. And there's always a little bit of change. Like, you know, one year it's like, oh my God, if you're not 20 years old, you're not going to go out for anything. And another, then it's like, oh, it's like, it's serious dramas or it's, you know, it kind of that ebbs and flows a little bit. But I think that, you know, what's happened in COVID, everybody's like gobbling up content. You know, like everybody's gobbling up the content, buying the scripts, and then how they get made and when they get made is, you know, nobody quite knows yet.
Exactly. Is there anything you're working on that you're excited about?
I'm waiting. I'm waiting like everybody else.
Like everybody else.
Like everybody else.
Phenomenal.
You know. So yeah, after, you know, we finished what we can, and now we have to, you know, wait for, you know, what comes up in January, if things are really, if there really is, you know, like these things that have been brewing that are like, oh, we think that's gonna start in February. I'm like, well, we'll see. We'll see if it is. We'll see if it is now.
So let me ask you a personal question. So now that I've asked all about processes, there's one thing that I like knowing, and because you work in American television so well, I'm kind of at the shift where I'm trying to push myself towards cameos, towards, you know, good supporting actor roles and stuff. And I get the occasional casting for an American television show, but like, what's the best piece of advice that you could give to an actor who, you know, who's fairly comfortable on screen and stage and stuff like that, and has been around the block a while? What's the difference in coming to a casting for a part where it's going to be a bit meatier? He's going to meet, you know, the producer's going to have a chat about it. What changes?
I mean, in terms of actually getting the role, like, or are you talking about like your process to get to that place?
Both, actually. I don't know if, I mean, I'm guessing a lot of those conversations are not going to be done with the actor. So it's like, it's going to be a lot of people talking about, is this guy right? Is it not? Shall we have another tape? But yeah, also, I don't know, does something change when you think, well, I got to be able to work with this guy for 3 months without killing him? And like,
yeah, I mean, I think casting for film and television, there's two differences. One is the audition process, and in terms of the choices, it's much more goal oriented. It's performance oriented. Like they want to see something pretty close to what they're going to get on the day.
Yeah.
Very close to what they're going to get on the day. In terms of, you know, for a series regular, it's about the range, you know, this person, we might live with them for 7 years, you know, is this, you know, person, you know, do we think that this person has, you know, a pretty big bandwidth of the kind of things that, you know, we're going to ask of them, because we don't know everything that we're going to ask of them, you know. And film, you know, in just a really general way, it is not quite as, you know, result oriented, because it can also be about a quality. It can be, I mean, it's a movie role that can live in that space and time for that 2 hours. That's all you're asking of that character.
Yeah.
If that, it's more specific, the bandwidth can be smaller. Not for, you know, I'm talking about in, you know, in the, you know, like cameo roles, like character roles, things like that. So that I think is a little bit different. It's definitely, you know, definitely result oriented in television and in the room. It's like, you know, there's not going to be rehearsal. There's not going to be, you know, a lot of discussion. I want to know that you can do it. And I want to know it's going to be, you know, it really close to what I'm seeing in the room. Really close. So that's, I think, a big difference.
Awesome. All right, Chris, any final questions or?
No, I think this was just a very nice chat. It was lovely to meet you, Deborah.
Lovely to meet you as well. Good luck on all of it.
Thanks. I'll need
on
it.
All of it. Don't we all?
Nah, it's going to be great. Honestly, I've got a good feeling about 2021. Can't be worse than 2020, right?
2020 was just like, you know.
Don't tempt fate.
I'm going to knock on wood.
Yeah, exactly. One day at a time.
That's right. Nowhere to go. Nowhere to go but up.
Exactly.
Exactly. It's been lovely talking to you guys. You guys enjoy the rest of your show.
Take it easy, Chris. Thanks for coming on, man.
Bye, Chris.
Bye. Bye. Awesome. All right. I'm mindful of your time, so I'm gonna wrap it up. But I like to wrap it up with just quick fire questions at the end here, taken from inside the actor's studio, because like all artists, we steal stuff. So the first question is
James Lipton was, you know, awesome.
Exactly. And and so you know, I feel like he got some good questions. I may as well take them from him. What is your favorite word? Is the first question.
Favorite word or swear word?
That comes later. That comes later.
That's hard just to pick one word. Joy. You know, I mean, I guess that's more of a feeling than the word itself, you know?
They're kind of intertwined, though, the feeling and the word itself. What's your least favorite word?
Least favorite word. Protuberance.
Ooh. I'm not gonna lie. That's,
I don't know. It just came out there. I don't know. I don't like that word.
It's gotta be, it's gotta mean something. What turns you on creatively?
Seeing other people live in the moment of whatever it is that they're creating. Just watching somebody else's juice, watching somebody else in the middle of, whether it's a piece of music, whether it's a painting, whether it's watching a performance. You know, it's funny. I watched, I watched the performance of Brian Dennehy do Death of a Salesman. It was like available to watch The Goodman a couple weeks ago. And I was like, man, I was just so turned on by that, because he's not even the kind of person that you necessarily, you know, most Willie Lomans are kind of beaten down and, you know, thin and small, and he's a bear of a man, you know. But I just, you know, to watch that kind of, you know, just somebody, that kind of fire, just that kind of like all in, that kind of just, you know, that turns me on. I like that.
It's that flow, isn't it? It's that kind of thing that we're all artistically trying. It's magic in a bottle that you can't really
right. I watched Saturday Night Live last week, and the Foo Fighters were on, who I love, and Dave Grohl, he sang this acoustic version of Times Like These. In the beginning, I was like, I love that song, and it was like, and it feels timely for this period. But I was just watching him, like, he must have, you know, sang that song, you know, thousands of times. But in that space, in that time, in that moment, he was, you know, like interpreting
his thing,
and just to watch people bring something to life, to watch people, you know, make me think about something that I haven't thought of before, see something in a way I haven't seen it before. And that's, you know, what, like, those performances that are, you know, that are just, that grab you, it's like, you know, it's a particular version of somebody's own interpretation of that. It's like not trying to be Brian Dennehy or trying to be,
sure,
you know, whoever, Nicole Kidman, whatever. Yeah. Dave Grohl. But like something unique, something that touches us, you know, like this touches you, like that really, that human connection.
But I think it's really, that's about it. The connection. Fact that the words didn't quite come to you is because that's what it is. It's not tangible almost in some way. It is, but words alone don't do justice to what that vibe is.
Right. And inspires a feeling, inspires a thought, inspires, you know, me to think about something.
Absolutely. See, there's hope that we're not going to be replaced by AI, all of us anyway.
I think that's true.
Because that's not going to happen from there. Okay, the flip and the next question is, what turns you off?
Smallness. Smallness means mean-spirited.
The next question, I think, is the one you've been waiting for, which is, what is your favorite swear word?
Oh, motherfucker.
That's a good one. Strong.
Right. Fuck nugget would be a second close one.
Wow. Okay.
that might be my own.
Motherfuckers come up a lot. Fuck nugget hasn't come up before. So that's definitely a new one.
Feel free.
We'll send you royalties. Anyone that uses fuck nugget, we'll just send you royalties. What's your favorite sound or noise?
Child's laughter.
And what's your least favorite sound or noise?
The sound of anguish.
Okay, final few. We're getting to the back end now. So the next one is, other than what you've done professionally, career wise, what job or profession would you most like to attempt?
In a fantasy world.
Sure. Why not?
You know, it's rock and roll, it's singing. Singing, right? That kind of fantasy. I like to work for a nonprofit.
Okay. There's a two totally different worlds as well. Two totally different kinds of rock.
There I am.
The polarity is just right there. There it is. What job or profession would you never want to do under any circumstance?
I don't think I could ever be a therapist. I think that would be too hard. I don't think I could divorce myself from that at the end of the day.
Sure. Yeah, you've got enough with casting to kind of deal with some of those little bits already.
I am a therapist.
And indirectly, but you don't want to go whole hog. No. Final question, a bit more ethereal. It's, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? What kind of legacy would you like to be?
Oh, that's a good question. To have lived a life of integrity and to have loved and been loved.
And to have rocked out, clearly. Clearly to have rocked out. Yeah. Amazing. Awesome. Listen, Debbie, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, really Ashley. Generous. That was fun.
I appreciate
it. That was fun.
Any closing remark to kind of button this off with people and we can round it up?
We can all, hold our collective breaths and it is going to come back and it will come back, but just to, don't get discouraged, either in the Zoom rooms or out of it, and, stay focused on your craft and do the thing that you love. Just, be passionate.
Amazing.
Be passionate.
Awesome. All right, Debbie, thank you so much.
All right.
To enjoy your
thank
day.
You. Take enjoy it easy. Your evening.
I All will. Right.